for his work was near the top of the list of his accomplishments. Daring and courage are half the battle with acting, directing, and filmmaking. If you have a newspaper reviewer or even the ghost of a generalized and antagonistic public over your shoulder, tutting and hissing in through their teeth as you try to concentrate, then you are doomed to failure. Ken, of course, does not associate his place in the world with guilt. He grew up in Northern Ireland in no position of prosperity. His love of theatre was inborn and absolute. Any money he managed to earn, he would spend on the ferry to the mainland and the bus to Stratford-upon-Avon, where he would watch every season from his early teenage onwards. It is no accident that he arrived to the first full day of shooting for Peter's Friends already filled with knowledge, courage, and self-belief. It is also, I would argue, no accident that Hugh and I arrived almost sick with apprehension, shame, and foreboding. The very good fortune that took us from our public schools, by way of other schools and prison in my case, via Cambridge, the Footlights, and into Blackadder, Jeeves and Worcester, and our own sketch show, far from filling us with confidence, made us feel utterly unworthy. Please don't think we are asking for sympathy, and certainly not for admiration. I speak as it was in our befuddled minds, and you may take it as you will. Perhaps if you have imagination, you can see yourself feeling the same way under the same circumstances. Perhaps we were just peculiarly weird. That a whole feature film could be shot in 11 days was testament to the work ethic of Ken and his crew, the tight unity of time and place within Martin and Rita's script, and of course, the sparsity of the budget. Meanwhile, the pleasure of having a car coming to pick me up from the Savoy and dropping me there in the evening was almost more thrilling than anything I had ever experienced. The top-hatted link men, often incorrectly referred to as doormen, were unfailingly polite to me, and I soon got to know the rest of the staff. If you want to know anything about the depths of degradation of the human being, make the acquaintance of the executive housekeeper of any large hotel. You will never be the same again. Discretion prohibits me from going any further. This is a journey you must undertake yourself. It's a bit like telling someone to look up the word munting in urbandictionary.com. I take no further responsibility. Otherwise, the joys of sweet-sitting were altogether delicious. No bathrobes were ever softer or fluffier, no shower rose wider or more generous in its precipitation. One small and entirely preposterous annoyance, however, something that got under my skin, was the daily sameness of it all. That ashtray on that table in the drawing-room was always placed exactly there. That chair always angled exactly that way. One day, I mentioned this to the floor butler. "Whenever I come back from filming or from a walk," I said, "the suite has been wonderfully cleaned and tidied, but, and I really don't mean this as a criticism, everything is always in exactly the same place. The ornaments on the mantelpiece, the..." "Sir, say no more. From tomorrow, we surprise you in small ways each day." Which they did. It made me, and I like to think the chambermaid and other staff members, giggle. Each time they made a small alteration. Playing Hunt the Ashtray kept me on my toes and freshened the experience of hotel living. One spare evening, I'd gone to see a production of Tartuffe, in which my good friend Johnny Sessions played a role. Also in the production was Dulcie Gray, whose husband, Michael Dennison, had played Algernon in Anthony Asquith's The Importance of Being Earnest, delivering the line, "I hope, Cicely, I shall not offend you if I state quite frankly and openly that you seem to me to be in every way the visible personification of absolute perfection." That very joyous progression of words that had so made me wriggle and writhe and squirm with delight when a young boy. Michael and Dulcie, a grand and much-loved theatrical couple, made a tradition of having a summer party at Shardalow's, a marvellous 18th-century house in Old Amersham, with noble Robert Adam interiors and a 1796 landscaped garden by Humphrey Repton. The house had been saved, restored, and divided up in the 1970s, after falling into the customary nursing home use and further slow decline. Dulcie and Michael had the best ground-floor rooms, giving out over the great lawn. Their party, when I arrived, was already crammed with figures from the British film and theatre world. I found myself falling into conversation with Doreen, widow of the great Jack Hawkins, one of my favourite British film stars. Then, Who should I see across the room? Did my eyes believe it? My favourite of them all, John Mills. A certain amount of excited hopping on one leg, a little light coughing, and I found myself sitting on a sofa next to him. He twinkled, just as I expected him to, this nimble, unutterably charming and deeply gifted man. His wife, Mary Haley Bell, author of Whistle Down the Wind, barked and laughed just as I expected her to. John Mills was the man Noel Coward wrote Mad Dogs and Englishmen for. In the mid-1930s, he had been a singer, hoofer, and all-round entertainer for a company with the unfortunate name of The Quaints. Coward, on a journey back from Australia, stopped off in Singapore and saw a poster offering the unlikely double bill, surely not in one night, of Hamlet and Mr. Cinders. It was in the latter that the lithe, lissom, and perky Mills impressed. Coward went round afterwards and told him to visit him in London, where he would find a part for him. Johnny Mills had a genius for friendship. Coward, whom he was the first to dub the Master, Laurence Olivier, Rex Harrison, Richard Attenborough, Brian Forbes, and many others benefited from his selfless and sweetly unegotistical charm. As we sat on the sofa at Chardelot's, I must have bombarded him with dozens of questions about his films and career, The October Man, In Which We Serve, Ryan's Daughter, Hobson's Choice, Tiger Bay, Swiss Family Robinson, and above all, Ice Cold in Alex, Great Expectations, and Tunes of Glory had affected me profoundly. When I paused to draw breath, Johnny asked me what I was up to. I explained that I was in the middle of making a picture with Kenneth Branagh. "Oh, no, really," said Johnny. "I wonder, would you do me a favour?" "Anything. Could you tell Kenneth that as a friend of Larry Olivier's, I just know how much Larry would have loved Kenneth's Henry V, and how much he would have loathed the vile comparisons the critics have made. Can you tell him that?" Johnny was referring to the fact that, while Ken's Henry V had been an undoubted success, many snarky responses along the lines of, "Who does he think he is? He's no Laurence Olivier," had greeted its release. "I'm afraid I can't pass that message on," I told Johnny. "Oh," he looked rather nonplussed. "I'd much prefer you to pass it on yourself. If I gave a dinner party, would you and Lady Mills come along?" He beamed assent, telephone numbers were swapped, and the thing was fixed. There is nothing quite like hosting a dinner party in a 5-star hotel suite. Yes, of course I'm aware how utterly appalling that sounds, but I might as well get the story out. Here's how it goes. You tell Alfonso and Ernesto on your floor that you plan to have 6 guests for dinner next Friday, and they bow with pleasure. When the day dawns, Ernesto comes in with a menu card and the suggestions from the executive chef and his team toiling in the hypercosts 6 floors below. You select what you hope is an agreeable dinner. Footnote: I bore in mind the fact told me years ago by my mother, who knows these things, when watching a Mills film, that Sir John had been for 50 years on the hay diet. When he was a young man, he had developed a stomach ulcer, then the most common cause of death of men under 40 in Britain. Today, of course, suicide is the most common. Someone recommended to him the hay diet, in which protein and carbohydrate are never combined. Vegetables are neutral. You can have steak and salad or pasta and salad. You can have cucumber sandwiches, but not cheese rolls. Ham and eggs for breakfast, or just pancakes. You get the idea. His ulcer was allayed, and for the rest of his life he remained trim. End of footnote. Back to the Savoy. At around about 6 o'clock, Alfonso, who doesn't want you under his feet while he sees to the flowers and place settings, comes in and commands that you go for a walk. When you arrive back at the suite, everything is simply perfect. The armchairs have been moved back towards the window, in a semicircle looking out over the Thames at dusk. In the centre of the room, the main table has had an extra leaf inserted to accommodate 7 people. I've invited Hugh and Joe Laurie, Emma Thompson and Ken, and of course Sir John and Lady Mills. Starched white napery, crystal glassware, and silver cutlery gleam in the candlelight. 2 low bowls of perfect peonies on the table, vases of roses and exquisite flowers I cannot identify, distributed about the room. On occasional tables, occasional nuts, olives and cornichons. Fortunately, this is the age before the uneatable Bombay mix or palate-destroying pretzel assortment. A bottle of champagne in a silver bucket shifts slightly in the ice. I pour a solacing vodka and tonic, light a cigarette, and pretend to myself that I am not a little nervous. When out on my walk, I withdrew enough cash to tip Ernesto, Alfonso, Gilberto, Alonso, and Pierre as lavishly as might be appropriate. I have arranged with Alonso that as soon as the first guest has arrived, he will come in to serve cocktails and the fizz. If he has not been alerted by reception, I will press the bell by the fireplace. A thought strikes me. Perhaps the front desk won't know who John Mills is. It would be dreadful if so august a figure should slip anonymously in without being treated with the respect he deserves. I call down. "Good evening, Mr. Fry." This was still a time when I got a little disconcerted by the hotel staff being able instantly to identify me as soon as I called. Hello, yes, it's me, Stephen here in 512. I just wanted to say that I'm having a dinner party, and the thing is, the guests of honour are Sir John and Lady Mills, and I hope you'll...
Oh, sir, we know Sir John very well indeed. Rest assured we shall welcome him most enthusiastically, most enthusiastically.
Hugh, Joe, Ken and Emma arrived together. We were still young enough to be excited by such a preposterously grown-up business as holding a dinner party in a place like the Savoy. Alonso made cocktails and stood discreetly by the drinks trolley as we giggled and shrieked. The buzzer sounded, and we all straightened up and put on serious but welcoming faces. I opened the door, and there stood Sir John and Mary. He stepped in and looked blinking about him.
Oh, it's...
I noticed with alarm that he had started to weep. "Sir John, is everything all right?" He took my arm and squeezed it tight.
"This is Noel's suite."
He let go and walked about. Every first night, this was the suite Noel took.
Oh, gracious!
It was a perfect evening. Johnny and Ken quickly made friends. Anecdotes rained down and many beans were spilled. The front desk had already made a great fuss of Johnny and Mary, lining up to greet him at the famous porte cochere as soon as his splendid old Rolls-Royce had arrived with his faithful driver, factotum and friend, John Novelli, at the wheel. It was the beginning of a long friendship between John, the Mills family, and me. Not long enough, as far as Johnny was concerned, of course. He died in 2005, at the age of 93, and Lady Mary, who had lost herself to dementia many years earlier, joined him in death later that year. Their 64-year marriage was an extraordinary achievement. I bumped into Johnny in 1996 in an artist's green room at the Sitges Film Festival. He peered up at me. He had been unable to see properly for at least 5 years by this time, and spent much of his charitable energy helping the Royal London Society for the Blind.
"Oh, Stephen, do you know something? This is the first time Mary and I have spent a night apart since we were married."
Astonishing. I once asked him what the secret of so strong a marriage might be. "Oh, it's very simple," he said. "We behave like naughty teenagers who've only just met. I'll give you an example. We were at a very grand dinner a couple of years ago, and I scribbled a note saying, 'Cor, I don't half fancy you. You doing anything afterwards? We could go to my place for some naughty fun.' Something like that. I summoned a waiter. 'You see that ravishing blonde at the table over there,' I said, pointing towards Mary. 'I wonder if you'd be good enough to hand her this note.' I was then rather horrified to realise, my sight was just going at this stage, you have to understand, that he was handing the note to Princess Diana. She opened it, read it, and with her eyes followed the waiter's pointing hand back to me, squirming in my seat. She smiled, waved, and blew a kiss. Oh dear, I did feel a fool. Two events gave me a special delight during my years of friendship with Johnny. One was the good fortune I had in spotting that Christie's were selling an old dressing gown of Noel Coward's. I won the auction and gave it to Johnny on his 80th birthday. He remembered Coward wearing it, and owning it gave him a remarkable amount of pleasure, which in turn, of course, gave me a remarkable amount of pleasure. The second event took place on a freezing winter's day in the grand old house Luton Hoo, former seat of the Marquesses of Bute, and latterly the diamond magnate Julius Werner, much of whose famous Fabergé collection was stolen from the house in a daring motorcycle raid. I was using it, some time after this burglary, as a location for scenes for the film Bright Young Things, an adaptation of Evelyn Waugh's second novel Vile Bodies. I tentatively asked Johnny one day whether he would consider playing the part of old gentleman at a ball. He immediately consented. I explained that what I wanted him to do in this scene was to spot Miles, a fey young man played by Michael Sheen, apparently taking a pinch of snuff from a small silver box. Miles would offer the old gentleman a pinch of this snuff, which was peculiarly white for milled tobacco, and then resignedly allow him to take more and more in odd moments when we returned to them as the ball progressed. Johnny was very excited to be playing his first drug scene so late in his life, and took it, as he did all his work, very seriously. Though just about stone blind and in a large, chilly house, he asked for nothing extra. We had made up a small interior tent for him, however, which we furnished with a daybed and 5-barred electric heater. A few years later, Johnny lay dying in a new house in Denham Village. The Gables, I think it was called, up the road from Hill's house, where they had spent so many years. I went to visit him. He had a chest infection and couldn't really speak, but I sat and held his hand. I had brought with me an iPod, on which I had uploaded as many Noel Coward numbers as I could find. He was dressed, as he liked to be, in a velvet jacket, his KBE and CBE medals proudly attached to his chest. I put the iPod down by his side and gently pushed the earbuds in. As I heard Coward's voice crooning, "I'll see you again," I saw his mouth form a smile and tears leak from the corners of his eyes. Back at the Savoy Hotel, a few days after the Mills Branner dinner party, I am waiting at 6 in the morning for my car to take me to Rootham Park for the day's filming on Peter's Friends. I find myself chatting to Arturo, one of the link men. "You a fan of Frank Sinatra, Mr. Fry?" "Am I? You bet I am." "Ah, well, he's coming to stay with us today." "You're kidding." On the ride up to Hertfordshire, I rehearsed what I'd say if I bumped into the great man. Old Blue Eyes, the chairman of the board. The voice. The filming, as it does, went on and on and on and on and on. It must have been past midnight before I drew up again at the Savoy. Arturo opened the door for me. "It was a long day, Mr. Fry." "Looks like it was for you, too." "Just started my shift, sir. Now, why don't you follow me? Something I'd like you to see." Baffled and faintly irked, all I could think of was bed, I trailed after Arturo along the passageway that led, and still does, to the American bar. We went down the steps, and Arturo pointed towards a man, sitting in a pool of light, head bowed over a crystal lowball glass, backlit cigarette smoke ribboning up. A living album cover. "Mr. Sinatra, I'd like you to meet Mr. Fry, a long-term guest." The man looked up, and there he was. He pointed to the chair opposite him. "Sit down, kid." Kid? Francis Albert Sinatra had called me kid. It reminded me of the moment in Richard Lester's The Three Musketeers, when Spike Milligan says in a stunned, reverent voice, after Charlton Heston has grasped his wrist and whispered him into conspiracy against his wife, Raquel Welsh, "The Cardinal has taken me by the hand and called me friend." I think I had about 3 minutes alone with Frank before the room was filled with old friends and I found myself pushed to the edge of the party. But it was enough, and I wound my way back to 512 as one in a holy dream. A few days later, I saw Arturo on duty again. I pumped him by the hand and pushed a fiver on him. As long as I live, I will never forget that moment, Arturo. What a favour you did me. I can never thank you enough.
It was my pleasure, Mr. Fry.
Is he still here? Left this morning.
Quite funny, actually.
Oh, yes?
Well, just before he got into his car for the airport, he gave me a roll of cash. Great thick roll it was. "Thanks for a terrific stay, Arturo," he says.
"Well, thank you very much, Mr. Sinatra. Always a pleasure for us to have you at the Savoy." "Tell me," he says, "is that the biggest tip you've ever had?" I look down at the money. Huge roll of 20s and 50s it was. "Well, as a matter of fact, sir, no it isn't," I says. He looks most put out, most put out. "Well, tell me," he says, "who gave you a bigger one?" "You did, sir. Last time you stayed," I says. He got into the car, laughing his head off. "And next time he stays, you'll get an even better tip," I said. "Oh, the thought never crossed my mind," said Arturo. Dear Diary. By 1993, Peter's friends had come out, Fry and Laurie had had a second series, and I had written my first novel, The Liar, and a collection of journalism essays and other scraps called Paperweight. I am an irregular diarist, but the months leading up to the completion of my second and favourite novel, The Hippopotamus, and the delivery to my flat of its galley proofs were well covered by me. I offer them to you because I think they recapture better than my memory ever can the hectic, intensely busy, and fractured nature of my life back then. That it was leading to a catastrophic explosion, I did not realize. Perhaps it will be apparent to you as you listen. I have retained loyal to the intentions laid out in the first entry, and have not altered or added, except for the sake of respect for those who would rather be kept out or have their identities masked. From time to time, footnotes have been added for the sake of clarity. Monday, 23rd of August, 1993, London. I'm going to be 36 tomorrow, 36, a quarter of a gross, a very factorable number, but otherwise nothing special. Nonetheless, it seems a good time to restart my diary. First resolution, no going back and altering this chronicle, no reading back, no emendations, no retrospective editorials. It must come out of me absolutely in one. Otherwise, what's the point? Huh. Oh, what's the point? The last words in Kenneth Williams's diary, just published and just skimmed through by me. I'm mentioned once in the index, a reference to an appearance on a Wogan that KW guest presented. Stephen Fry, OK. That's my reference. An epitaph. Listening to Strauss's Alpine Symph while writing this. It's on Radio 3 as a prom. Rather wonderful version by some Russian conductor I've not heard of. Footnote. Almost certainly Valery Gergiev, who has since become a kind of friend. End of footnote. Introduced in traditionally hushed tones by James Naughty. Naughty James sat next to me at the John Burt Cup final lunch earlier in the year. Nice chap. Lazy day today. Very lazy. Like all the days I've spent recently. Having such a reputation for hard work is satisfactory and bolsters my amour propre, but it is such a lie. Spent most of the day polishing off the seating plan for tomorrow's birthday dinner. How can it take that long? Well, I've decided to do anagrams for the guests' names. Here's a list with explanations. Henry F. Pest, me. Lacey Easy Fleece, Alice Faye Cleese, wife of John Cleese, Oaky psychotherapist. Irma Shirk, Kim Harris, darling friend from Cambridge. Lady Orlash, Sarah Lloyd, wife of John. Mercy H. Twat, Matthew Rice, sweetie designer and splendor. Sonia Wanktorn, Rowan Atkinson. Katie Labial Scar, Alastair Blackie, friend of Kim, agent and my gardener. Marty Badgermew, Emma Bridgewater, wife of Matthew Rice, designs crockery. Jones Leach, John Cleese. Mariah Silwash, Sarah Williams, producer, currently back with Nick Simmons. Harold Clitshine, Christian Hodell, assistant of Lorraine. Julie Orr, Joe Laurie, wife of J.H.C. Laurie. Coke Toper, Peter Cook. Reg Gowns, Greg Snow, friend from Cambridge. Slim Noble, Simon Bell, Oxonian layabout and charmer. Nick Cool, Lynn Cook, wife of Peter. Dolly John, John Lloyd, producer of Blackadder and so on. Mario Nolan Hitler, Lorraine Hamilton, my agent. Miss Nancy L. Soho, Nicholas Simmons, old Cambridge chum, producer of Bit of F and L. Antonius Stanker, Sunitra Atkinson, wife of Rowan. Eli Sider, Eric Idle. Uriah H. Glue, Hugh Laurie. Anyway, spent all fucking day working out those anagrams. Alice Faye Cleese, way the hardest. All those bloody E's and Y's. Footnote. Some might think her anagram, Lacey Easy Fleece, rather appropriate, given the astounding settlement awarded her when J.C. and she divorced. You might think that, but I couldn't possibly comment. End of footnote. All this time taken up while I should have been working on the Nov. Satisfactory in its way. In the background, Radio 3, not music this time, but the test match. England won, can you believe? Never doubted them. Atherton, clearly good captain. He'll have his hellish moments in the years to come, but a sound fellow. While I strained my verbal skills on this useless anagrammary, which will probably annoy the guests tomorrow anyway. No bloody fun in the world anymore. No one doing mad, silly things. No one playing practical jokes or organising stupid parties with games and tricks like they did in the 20s. Even melancholy Virginia Woolf. Heard Dame Edna on Kaleidoscope a year or so back. Darling Virginia, a woman with whom I have so much in common, except, of course, that I can swim. Footnote. Kaleidoscope was a BBC Radio 4 arts programme, forerunner of Front Row. Even Virginia Woolf and her set used to love practical jokes. Everyone's so sodding serious and ordinary now. God knows whether the seating plan will work. If Simon Bell is sober, it'll help. Well, I'll report the day after tomorrow. Talking of the morrow, although my birthday, I seem to have filled it up with interviews to publicise Stalag Luft, endless TV magazines and similar. Bottle of wine at my elbow, Cannon Cop, a South African claret mimic, not enough tannin. Strauss's Storm is brewing up, all those fluty interjections seem borrowed from Rossini's William Tell Overture, or I'm a Flying Dutchman. Tuesday, 24th of August, 1993, London. Well, 36 then. Usual cliché of searching for grey hairs in the mirror. Some individual white flecks around the temples, but it's hard to tell whether they're real or a trick of the light. The whole morning given over to publicity interviews for Stalag Luft at the Groucho. Endless stream of women from TV Quick, TV First, TV Super, TV Cunty, all wanting to talk about my celibacy. Surely you must fantasize. Surely you must meet people and fancy them. Basically, they want to know what pictures go on in my mind when I masturbate. Had the same thing a few weeks ago when I went to dinner at Ken and M's. Ken got a bit in his cups, doesn't take more than a glass with him, and he was all, "Come on, darling, what do you think about when you wank?" M tried to slap him, but I bet she was too intrigued really to mean it. Very pleased that my dreams and fantasies aren't too out there. I mean, only today, the papers are full of this Michael Jackson thing, some woman apparently reporting him for abusing her son. Let's face it, whoever doubted that Jacko was a boy lover. My God, there's going to be a fall there if they find anything at his ranch, porn, film, whatever. Poor deranged sod. I don't think his own childhood fell far short of abuse in its way. Then the party. Everyone turned up. Everyone got me presents, though I told them not to. The anagram seemed to tickle them all, too. Most people in a good mood and seeming to enjoy it. Even Rowan managed to last to the end. Footnote. Usually notorious for bowing out of parties with a gentle yawn at about 9 p.m. End of footnote. I sat next to Joe Laurie and Alice Faye Cleese. I put Hugh down the other end near Eric and John C. Peter Cook in great form, talking about Derek and Clive, which is about to be re-released. Most people lightly drunk by the end. The bill came to almost exactly £1,000, which is reasonable, I would say. Damn good tuck. Did I mention earlier that it was 190 Queensgate, run by Anthony Worrell Thompson, who was there and joined for a drink earlier on? Turns out he was at school with John Lloyd, home with Simon Bell, whom I gave a whiskey before he eventually left. Wednesday, 25th of August, 1993, London. Voiceover with Hugh this morning for Energizer Batteries. Hugh in good form, which is always a treat. A fun 1.5 hours. Bumped into Norman Beaton before going into the sound studio. Mad old duck, rather a fan, wants us to write a sketch for him to be in. Afterwards, a lot of leisurely shopping down Cecil Court. Bought an original Vanity Fair print of Gillette as Holmes, and a signed photograph of Basil Rathbone. Don't ask me why. Might make a good present. Also got hold of a copy of Ricky Jay's book, Learned Pigs and Fireproof Women, which I've been after for ages. Footnote, wasn't so easy to source a book in the days before the World Wide Web and Amazon and so on. End of footnote. Eventually, got him in time to read a little before popping out to the Institute of Directors in Pall Mall, just around the corner. This was to meet a man by the name of Robin Hardy, who is producing a film called Bachelors Anonymous, nothing to do with the Woodhouse story of the same name. He wants me to play the second lead and to direct it. Flattering and pleasing that he can be confident enough to give such a relatively big movie to a first-time director, but there is a problem. Firstly, is the script good enough? He has written it himself from a novel called Fox Prince by Patrick McGinley. Really rather fascinating, but needs improvement so as not to look misogynistic or just plain silly. The major problem, though, is when. I've got to try and finish the novel soon. Then I spend from October to January writing with Hugh for a bit of F&L Series 4. Then we make the thing. 6 weeks of studio, rehearse, record. That takes us to the end of March. John Reed will, I assume, want to go with the Elton musical next, and the BBC will make noises about filming the adaptation of The Liar. There's no chance I could start pre-production prep on Bachelors until end of June, which would mean shooting it in September, over a year from now. Mad to think my life is that booked up. And where does that leave a second script for Paramount and Hugh's film Galahad? Why is my life always like this, and why am I complaining about it? He seems a reasonable fellow, this Hardy. Strange place to meet, the IOD. He fits it rather well, having a rather box-waller version of an upper-class accent. He did, on the other hand, write and direct The Wicker Man, a great classic. I feel it odd that I've never heard of him. Lorraine Hamilton is running a background make to see what she can see. Perhaps it will be a good thing to do, direct a film. I feel I can. I lack a lot of common sense, always have done, but I think I'll keep my head above water with a good operator, a good first, and someone like Dougie Slocum to light the film. Law, what to do? What to do? Just aren't enough hours in the frigging day, are there, Stephen Oldlove? Thursday, 26th of August, 1993, London. Parents are going to arrive at any minute. Father's birthday. I'm taking them to the premiere of Ken's Much Ado tonight at the Empire Leicester Square, and then to a party at Planet Hollywood, of all places, so I'll do this entry now, rather than tonight, when they'll be hanging around the flat. Actually, spent most of the day doing no more than preparing for their arrival, hiding all the Euroboy videos, tidying up, trotting over the road to Fortnum's to buy fruit, flowers, tea things and so forth, spent a merry hour in Hatchard's buying books, got Alan Clark's diaries, signed, for Father, as well as the new Bill Bryson, as he likes him, and a biography of Einstein, not the salacious one. For myself, I rounded up a lot of books on theology, mostly beginner's stuff. All this reading of Susan Howitt recently has got me interested in knowing more about the subject. I don't believe in God, of course, but I sometimes think I want to believe. And then there's that foolish vision of myself as a bishop, sermonizing and saving the poor old C of E from itself. So fond of the C of E. The broad-backed hippopotamus, as T.S. Eliot called her. So much better a liturgy and the music. Russell Harty, footnote, TV chat show host, a simply adorable man who died from hepatitis B in 1988, end of footnote. Russell Harty once confidingly said to me, while playing hymns at the piano, he had a perfect ear and could play anything you named that he knew, "I don't think I could ever love anyone who didn't love English hymns." Mind you, being a Roman Catholic, his last lover, the sweet Jamie O'Neill, couldn't have known much Anglican church music. Footnote. Jamie struggled after Russell's untimely death in 1988, but then wrote the wonderful At Swim Two Boys, one of the best Irish novels of the past however many years. End footnote. Appalling arrogance of me to think I would be a good church leader without the concomitant of a shred of faith. Very Henry Crawford. Footnote. The wicked cad in Jane Austen's Mansfield Park, whose casual allusion to how good a parson he would have made, had he minded to become one, so shocks Fanny the heroine, who is shocked by everything, to be honest. End footnote. Mind you, probably a better life than my other footling fantasy, Fry the Politician, Fry the Scourge of the Right, and Hero of the Chamber. Also, bought a first novel called In the Place of Fallen Leaves. Simply ghastly title, but Roger, the sweet old queen at Hatchard's, recommended it. Footnote, and rightly, it went on to win the Hawthornden Prize, which had been recently resurrected by the munificent Drew Hines, widow of the 57 Varieties chap, and the author, Tim Pears, went on to write the hugely successful In a Land of Plenty. End of footnote. Still haven't been able to face my own novel. I'm banking on being able to work when I get to Greyshot on Saturday, but how is one to tell? I'm always assuming that words will come, and that I'll be able to get down that tunnel of concentration when I put my mind to it, but there's so much to do, and I do desperately want it to work. If I don't finish it this year, it'll spill over into next, and then what happens to the idea of directing, or the TV version of The Liar, or the Elton John thing, or Galahad, or God knows what else besides? I'll report on Much Ado tomorrow. I've seen it already at a preview cinema months ago. Really enjoyed it then, but perhaps it'll be less fun in front of a bigger audience, and now that I have expectations. Hugh made a good point about how Ken, on film, sometimes does this thing of laughing and throwing his head back and slapping people on the back when wit is being offered. He did it in Peter's Friends, and he does it in Much Ado, clearly encouraging his cast to do the same. Especially, of course, the blissful Brian Blessed, who roars like a speared ox through most of his scenes. Hugh's theory is that actors laughing prevents audiences from laughing, and that this is perhaps true of screen or stage tears as well. Rather a convincing idea. And no doubt the Branagh haters and Ben Elton haters will be out in force anyway. Footnote. Ben played Verges. End of footnote. I'm so lucky that I don't seem to be quite so despised as they do. Mind you, not as admired either, which is only right. I suppose people think of me as some kind of reliable old thing, rather than as a threat. Ken and Ben are certainly threatening. Those who dislike them regard them as the kind of yappy Jack Russells who leap up and spunk all over your trouser crease. The snobbery in Britons makes them believe that I, on the other hand, however rude or lefty I may seem, am fundamentally sound and reasonable, like a trusty Labrador. Frankly, I'm too lucky. Filled in a Guardian questionnaire the other day. In answer to the question, when and where were you happiest, I answered, at the risk of tempting Providence, I'm pretty chipper at the moment, as it happens. Tempting Prov is right. Even now, in Plum's immortal phrase, fate must be lurking around the corner, quietly slipping the horseshoe into the boxing glove. Shit, there goes the doorbell. Here are the parents. Friday, 27th of August, 1993, London. Well, they arrived yesterday, admired the flat, and seemed in good order and spirits despite a visit to their accountant. Impossible to imagine how things are with them. They just carry on as always, the business continuing in its gentle way, mother doing the VAT, father exercising his extraordinary mind. I'm more certain that that man could have been absolutely anything he wanted to be in the world than I am of almost anything else. The gloss of complete admiration may well have worn off in some regards. There's no question that he seems curiously unsophisticated to me now, but his mind is still a remarkable thing. Anyway, after teeing them and cocktailing them, we sallied forth on foot for the Empire Leicester Square. Unbelievable crowds. A greater number, according to today's papers, than turned out for the opening of Jurassic Park, which says something for Ken and Em. We approached naturally from the west, only to discover that the crash barriers were arranged such that we had to walk all the way round and enter from the Charing Cross Road end. Highly embarrassing. Many cries of Steve! And applause as I trotted the gauntlet, parents in tow. I suppose it must have been strange for them, really, to walk with me and know that everyone there was cheering their son and knew who he was. Lot of posing for the paparazzi outside the doors, and then I managed to get inside. Naturally, the really smart ones were indoors, including Richard Young, who really is extraordinary. He instantly sidled up and said, out of the side of his mouth, "Those your parents, then?" And I said, amused, "Yeah," and he asked for a shot with them. I reckon that man could tell instantly if two people enter a party whether or not they're sleeping together. Remember that Greek saying, "It's easier to hide two elephants under your arm than one pathic?" After Richard, there were endless TV crews. God knows how many showbiz and local news programmes there are these days. Footnote. A lot fewer than there are now, Stephen Young Sausage. End footnote. All wanting pre- and post-screening comment. Oh, dear me. On TV, as I type this, there's a documentary about a man with cystic fibrosis going on in the background. Sounds of a great quantity of mucus expression going on. Up at the party, there was a sprinkling of theatrical nightage. Sir John Mills and Mary, who both kissed me sweetly. Johnny kissed my mother, which was divine of him. Dickie, now Lord Attenborough, was there, and Sir Peter Hall. A couple of Peter's friends, stalwarts, Alphonsia and Tony S. Footnote, Alphonsia Emmanuel and Tony Slattery, who were also in Peter's Friends. Richard Curtis, of Four Weddings fame, unkindly remarked that surely Alphonsia Emmanuel is a drag name. You might think that, but I, CPC. End footnote. And of course, Ken and M, the latter looking divine, the former surprisingly like Noel Edmonds. Kim Harris turned up with Hugh. Kim looks absolutely zonked. A few months ago, Ken rang up and asked me to rewrite Frankenstein. It was exactly when I was shooting off to Texas to make an episode of Ned Blessing, a new Western series for CBS. I played Oscar Wilde, directed by David Hemmings, of all people. I told Ken I couldn't do it, but suggested that he try Kim. Well, it seems Kim has turned out well, but is being driven like a dray horse by Sir Kenwood. Just as well I said no, I suppose, though it would have been fun to meet Robert De Niro. I hope Kim is all right. One worries when he gets so tired. Eventually the reception broke up to go into the cinema, and we watched the movie. Speeches by Stephen Evans, the Renaissance film supremo, and Ken. The film was even more moving the second time around. Still thought that Michael Keaton and Ben were a little out of their depth, but M was staggeringly good, of course, and Ken fabulously likable and witty. I hate the way I've been influenced by the critics. As I watched, I started to notice flaws in the lighting and background action. Brian Blessed's heartiness and the general laughing and merriment now grated a little. Nonetheless, a wonderful movie, and what a reaction. The whole place stood and cheered for ages, a genuine, spontaneous, standing ovation. It made me cry, I'm afraid to say. Ken really is a mensch and a half. The party afterwards was at Planet Hollywood, which I hadn't visited since that bizarre opening party with Bruce Willis, Schwarzenegger et al. Parents still excited and merry. Richard Briers, who is about the kindest man in the universe, stopped and chatted to them for ages. They were the only people in the room for him. I do hope I'm not a starer-over-the-shoulder type person, but give whomever I'm talking to my full attention as Dickie B does. Mother and father are the same. The only difference was that Dickie toned his language down a bit. Normally, he starts every sentence with, "Fucking hell, love," no matter whether he's bumming a cigarette or admiring a building. After next standing about with Richard Curtis and Emma Freud for a bit, we were invited over to the area where Ken and M had booked a table. Chatted a lot to Paul Boateng, the MP, who was in merry form and wearing rather startling clothes. Cozed a bit with Slatbum, footnote, Tony Slattery, end footnote, and his boyfriend Mark, who's just won a Drama Desk Award in New York. They met on Me and My Girl years ago. Footnote, still together, sentimental gulp, end footnote. Rather touching. Dan Patterson turned up, despite a recent operation. Anthony Andrews has absurdly petite hands and feet. Sounds like a Clary Hugh, and ludicrous Prince Charles mannerisms, but otherwise seems a very charming cove. There was an unbelievably choice young man with blonde hair with whom I exchanged smiles. At 1:30 or so, I managed to tear the parentals away, and we sloped off back home. Still an enormous crowd outside the place when we left, lots of photography and signing before we could get away. Now we're back to today. Arose at 9-ish, said goodbye to M&P, and joined Hugh for a VO. Alliance and Leicester radio commersh. In Tottenham Court Road, bought a lot of jock straps, trainers and so forth, ready for grey shot. Watched a video when I got home, a film called The Living End, billed as an irresponsible movie. It's about a couple of guys, both HIV positive, who decide to let the world go hang and jag about the States fucking and shooting, sort of Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer for the smart gay set. Witty, neatly done, despite abominable sound recording. At 3, I wandered about Soho, fetched up at the Groucho, where Simon Bell, surprise, surprise, was propping up the bar, had a couple of glasses of wine, and biffed off to Mag Masters for another VO. I rang Johnny Sessions to see if he felt like hitting the West End this evening, but he was having another of his old chums to dinner, plus wife, so I've decided to stay in with a bottle of Fleury and some videos. Just watched the original episode of The Sweeney, and must now decide on another. But tomorrow, tomorrow sees a new Stephen, a hard-working, concentrating, novelising, non-drinking Stephen. Jo Laurie rang to say goodbye. Her new baby will be hitting the straw while I'm away. She told me Kim was okay, just healthily tired. But one day I'm going to hear that he is ill, and I'm going to know what that ill means. It's impossible to believe. Fuck it, he's 35 and there's a time bomb inside him. It's all just happening, too. The Frankenstein, the relationship with Alistair, which seems so good, makes you vomit, doesn't it? God blast AIDS. Spent a merry hour writing notes for my brother Roger, who's going to be borrowing the flat with his wife and my two nephews Ben and William. Arranged with the manager of Planet Hollywood that they could barge the queue with my special celebrity card, which I left for their use. Showed on the map where it was and where the nearest chops were. Hope they have a good time. Saturday, 28th of August, 1993. Greyshot Hall, Surrey. Well, for heaven's sake. Greyshot Hall, once apparently the home of Alfred Lord Tennyson, is now a health retreat, featuring spas, hydros, gyms, golf, tennis, badminton. It's beginning to sound like that speech of Lucky's from Waiting for Godot. Swimming, snooker, Scrabble, bridge, and the Lord knows what else besides. I arrived for lunch and found myself in what I subsequently discovered to be the light diet room, where salads and a gently cooked poussin seemed not unconscionable. At 1:30 I had an appointment with Liz, who checked my blood pressure, weighed me, 16 stone and a lot, yuck, and asked me what sort of treatments I required. Everything here is a treatment. If you had sex with one of the waiters, it would be called an erotic treatment. Drink, alcohol treatment, is not offered here. No bad thing. There is a smoking room, complete with card tables and so forth, which hasn't been made impertinently uninhabitable, which is something. I haven't volunteered for any particular treatments, though reflexology is something I've had before and is rather relaxing and splendid. I might, for the hell of it, try smoking hypnotherapy too. And there's some kind of men's facial, which teaches you how to shave. Come to think, no one has ever taught me to scrape the face, and for all I know, I've been doing it wrong all my life. Included in the price, £150 per day, footnote, now between £300 and £700 PD, end footnote, there is a heat treatment, steam room, hot box or sauna, and a Swedish massage. Reminds me of Shrublands, the health resort you see in Never Say Never Again, footnote, Sean Connery's 1983 remake of Thunderball. Rowan Atkinson made a brief appearance in it, end footnote, but not quite so grand. I book myself a deep tissue massage, which sounds potentially painful for 10 a.m. tomorrow. Actually, the place is quite pleasant. Mostly women here. Everyone is encouraged to go round the place in dressing gowns and tracksuits all day, so no formality, which is a blessing. I suppose the fellow guests are what you would expect. Rich Totteridge jewellery, executive wives and thin girls who certainly have no need of this kind of regime. My room is pretty Spartan, actually. I applied this afternoon for a suite, should it become available. Started work on the novel anyway, which, let's face it, is the point of being here. I don't know. I really don't know. I'm going to have to plan it out, and that's a fact. I know how bad I am at planning. Never did any with articles, with essays at Cambridge or school, but in this instance, it's got to be done. There are so many threads. The novel has to be about the redemption, if that isn't too ghastly a word, not of the hero, Ted Wallace, that's his current name anyhow, though I'm getting annoyed with having to avoid the inelegant said Ted, which everyone will think it's about, but rather of those around him. He's a poet, and knows that poetry is chthonic, not ethereal, of earth and water, not fire and air. It's also seemingly about purity and the operation of grace, and horrifically dull and off-putting brideshead-y things, but that isn't my problem. My problem is structural. I have to find a way of pulling together the past and present, and getting the characters introduced properly. At the current pace, the novel won't get to the halfway stage till I've written 100,000 words. I'm quarter of the way to 80,000, which is an acceptable novel length, but it looks as if this is going to be longer, which is the last thing I want. And there's nothing worse than reading a novel where you sense the writer has speeded up towards the end. I've got to remain true to the idea of it. One of the problems with The Liar was my lack of confidence that people would be interested enough in Healy and Cartwright, so I shoved in all the spying crap, which in fact most people found less interesting than Adrian in Love. I mustn't make the same mistake again. Anyway, I wrote for a few hours, then dined on plaice and vegetables, washed down with plain water, and followed by fruit. Came back to the room, couldn't work any more. Watched some dreadful Brian Dennehy film called The Revenge of the Father. Tomorrow, massage and a quick 9 holes before breakfast accepted, must see me at work. Sunday, 29th August 1993, Greyshot. Not much to report. Up at 7:30, breakfast was a mess of cottage cheese, all bran and coffee. Whether or not the coffee here is decaffeinated, I can't really tell, which I suppose means that it doesn't matter. Played 9 holes on the golf course. No hole is longer, which suits me, than 150 yards. Tried out for the first time The Killer Whale, which John Lloyd, footnote, producer of Not the 9 o'clock News, Spitting Image, Blackadder, and in 2003, QI, end footnote, gave me as a thank you for doing his South Bank Show comedy special. Sliced it, which is a first for me, as I usually hook. Had my massage after that. I didn't realise you were supposed to arrive half an hour earlier for the heat treatment, so I missed that. Kept my swimming trunks on all the time under my towel. All the fat men with hairy backs, who all resemble Arionassis and Picasso, waddled around slapping their bellies and showing their acorns, but I was damned if I was going to. I'm not having some For Women magazine telling the world about my cock length. Had the Swedish massage, which was nothing special, and went back to the room to work. Making some progress, but I need a breakthrough, there's no question about that. The chances of my finishing this novel for publication in the spring are remote in the extreme. Spoke to the front desk about changing the room. I'll be moving into more luxurious quarters tomorrow. Monday, 30th of August, 1993, Greyshot. Yup. I'm in room 5 now. It has coffee-making equipment, a minibar containing mineral water and skimmed milk, complimentary flowers and fruit basket, and all the things one has come to expect in one's life these days, tee-hee. They sent me a letter telling me about the new room rate. This suite is £298 per night, as opposed to the old rate of £195, but what the fuck? In this letter, they said, and I quote, "We are now requesting all guests to refrain from smoking in the bedrooms. However, the functions of the billiard and smoking rooms have not changed." What a fucking nerve. Some slatternly skivvy has gone and squealed, by which I mean some plump, currenty sweetness of a chambermaid has informed the management of my in-room, self-administered tobacco treatment. Thing is, I'm turning into that character Ted Wallace in my frigging novel. It's not like me to call chambermaids slatternly. Another 9 holes this morning, and then waddled off in my dressing gown to experience the steam room effect. Horrific place. Some old boy sweating it out next to me said it was newly installed. He's a regular, must be rich as Croesus. It's like a sauna, but to be frank, not quite as unpleasant, as the humidity is exceptionally high. A minute takes a quarter of an hour to pass. Horrifying. Still contrive to keep my bathers on, though. Everyone must be beginning to talk about my strange modesty. Much better massage, however. Chap called Pete. I'll try and stick with him. Midway through the afternoon, I genuinely despaired with the novel. I've changed its working title to The Thaumaturge, as much to annoy the critics as anything. I came within an ace of packing up and moving either back to London or to some country house hotel where I could drown my sorrows in lonely jugs of claret. Then two things happened. Firstly, a man came in with an ashtray and said I was welcome to smoke in the room. They must have seen me nipping down to the smoking room and billiard room every half an hour and taken pity. And then I had an idea. A whole chapter that I've written should be in the form of a letter from Ted to his goddaughter Jane. It may not work out fully, but it's driving me along a little. Wrote a couple of thousand words after that. Still not enough, but let's hope it's a good sign. Have to go to London tomorrow, chiz. A VO for Compaq Computers. I'll drive to Hazelmere, get on a train, and hope to be back by two-ish. Wonder if I'll be a naughty boy and guzzle sandwiches on the train. Nothing but chicken and fish and fruit and veg so far. Night-night. Tuesday, 31st of August, 1993, Greyshot. Well, frankly, rose with the lark. Lark rise under candlewick, you might say. Drove like stink to Hazelmere, parked the car, and discovered that I'd left my wallet back in the room at Greyshot. Fortunately, God knows how or why, I'd got my checkbook with me. Avoided the queue for the tickets and jumped straight on the 806 to London. Sat all of a quiver in a second-class smoker, wondering what the issue would be. A ticket conductor arrived some time after Woking. Lord, home counties place names have such negative evocations, don't they? And I explained the position. Thank God for fame, he recognised me and seemed tickled pink, as did my fellow passengers, regular commuters to a man, and I mean man, said something about it being a good way of making his quota, there's a surcharge, natch, and waddled off. Fetched up at Waterloo at 0900 precisely, and, having not a bean to my name, well, 40-odd pence, I walked all the way over the bridge, along the Strand, and to St. James's. Halfway out the Strand, I remembered that Roger, Ruthie, Ben and William were all staying in the flat. Thought they may have left for Norfolk, but arrived to find plenty of traces. Assuming they were out for brekka at Fortnum's or somewhere, I left them a note and haired off to Lexington Street where the voiceover was. The sweet girl at the tape gallery, the studio, cashed a cheque for 50 quid, thank God. The VO, for Compaq Computers, yar-boo, was booked as a two-hour session, but I finished it to their satisfaction in 25 minutes, my internal clock going great guns. They wanted each of the VOs to last 18 seconds, and I duly obliged, first crack out of the box with each of the seven scripts. Scuttled back to the flat. Breeder the cleaner was there, but no sign of R&R. Hung around for an hour in case they showed, and then got a cab back to Waterloo. Car at Hazelmere, amazingly, not towed away, so I was back at Greyshot in time for a nutritious lunch. A chappie told me that Imelda Staunton was staying, so I arranged to meet her at the cocktail hour, 6 o'clock. Heat treatment and massage at 3. Actually took my clothes off this time. Mustn't do exclamation marks, it's so Adrian Mole. That's all Mummy's fault, she does them in letters to the milkman. Everything, thank you, exclamation mark, and so on. The less efficient masseur, Steve, did the business. Must remember to ask for Peter next time. Got back to the room, worked on the thaumaturge, which seems to me coming along okay, and dipped down for revivifying cocktails with Imelda and her mother Bridie, an Irish poppet, the spit of Imelda. Cocktails, you should understand, comprise either cucumber or tomato juice, but actually that's fine. Imelda, who's 8 months pregnant, was telling me all about Jim Carter, her man, footnote, now known the world over for his portrayal of the Downton butler, end footnote, and his nightmare shooting on a film of Black Beauty for Warners, all the horses misbehaving and that kind of thing. Peter Cook's in it, too. Anyway, then dinner, and now, before I hit the mattress, not like a mafioso, fortunately, a video. I collected an armful from the flat. Time, I think, to enjoy Jeremy Brett once more, this time in The Dancing Men, one of the best home stories. Sleep tight. Wednesday, the 1st of September, 1993. Greyshot. And a pinch and a punch to you. Doing this diary must be good for me. I had an inspiration last night after writing yesterday's entry. I suddenly saw that, of course, the thaumaturge is not David, but Simon. I had thought all along that David, the pure poetical son of the Logan family, would be the miracle worker. But of course, it must be the apparently dull, ordinary, less intelligent or sensitive boy. That's the poetic truth, as opposed to the poetical one. There's a sense in which I'm saying my brother Roger is the miracle worker of our family, not me, and I think that's true. He's decent, no, more than decent. He's good. Decent in the way Tom Wolfe means it in Bonfire of the Vanities. He's hard-working, he's loyal, he's true, he's... well... he's what makes man great, Sounds sententious put like that, I suppose. The key to it in the novel, though, means that at least some kind of twist or surprise can be guaranteed. Everyone was fooled by Davy, who deliberately allows Jane and Ted to believe that he's the one. Talking of the diary, this being the first of the month, I've decided I will print out an entry at the end of each month. This will guarantee that I can't go back and change things. That's the devil of a computer-kept diary. It looks impersonal, and there's no assurance that it hasn't been tarted up. When I get back to London, I will print out all of August. It only started late in the month, of course. Usual nine holes. Got a birdie! Yippee! My first! I was playing the six iron as Brendel plays a Burzendorfer today. Usual steam business, followed by a massage from Peter, who is infinitely better than Steve. I've asked the desk if I can always have him. There should be no problem. Then I had a consultation with the sister. I have lost £8 in the time I've been here. £8! Unbelievable! I only arrived halfway through Saturday. Hogged a load of sandwiches on the road, on Saturday morning anyway. 3.5 days. Over £2 a day. I won't be able to keep it up at this rate, but still, not bad, eh? In the afternoon, sister's advice, I had a holistic massage. All kinds of bollocks from Janice the masseuse about energy and channeling and healing and so forth, but I have to say it was a wonderful feeling. An hour and a half of intensely gentle yet intensely deep massage. Felt very woozy afterwards, but then keyed up and raring to go. Imelda and Bridie joined me in the light diet room for dinner, and we chatted about this and that. Since then, I've been working on the Nov. Spent most of this evening trying to write a poem that David Logan, who's aged 15, could have written. Tricky. Can't be too sophisticated, but no point if it's too childish. Takes bloody ages, poetry. Can't wait to get back to dialogue and description. I need words by the thousands! Oh no! More Adrian Moling! Exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark. Nighty-night. Thursday, 2nd September, 1993. Greyshot. Well, usual thing, really. Nothing too outrageous to report. Nine holes in the morning. Started badly, but really began to hit the ball well. Yawn, yawn, yawn. And felt good about the game. Came back, steam room and massage as per usual. Lots of work, then lunch. Some work after lunch, then decided to take half an hour off to play another nine holes. Really, genuinely, actually, frankly, properly hitting the ball. Very exciting. On the ninth, the pro was walking past as I hit the ball from the tee, spang on line with pin, right onto the green. Good shot, he said. From a pro. Back to the novel. It continueth. I've done an exhaustive word count. 30,034 words so far. That means I've written 9,174 since I've been here. That's an average of 1,529 per day, which isn't frankly enough to get the thing finished when I want it finished. But, and it's a but the size of Hyde Park, I am sure I'm writing more each day. It started slowly after all, so perhaps things aren't doing too badly. Do wish I was in Norfolk, though. I'd have had the thing finished a fortnight ago if I could have been in Norfolk. And I'd have saved myself the £3,000 or £4,000 bill I'm going to get for this little lot, let alone the gigantic cost of the building work that's being done in Norfolk. By fuckery, it had better be worth it. Hey-ho, Fry and Laurie on in half an hour. Might as well catch it. Sleep'ems, well'ems. Friday, 3rd of September, Greyshot. Well, watched F&L all right. Not bad, actually. Laughed in places. But Christ, I wish I didn't always wear such a smug expression. My face in repose always looks as if it's smirking, which is peculiarly repellent. Usual thing this morning. Nine holes. A step back in competence this AM, but made up for by a screamer at the ninth again. Steam, massage, lots of writing, and then, as a treat, a flotation and facial in the afternoon. The float is a strange bath, barely long enough for me to lie in, filled with salts, so that the water takes on the buoyancy and viscous consistency of the Dead Sea. You go into an anteroom, shower, smear Vaseline over any abraded skin, bung wax in your ears like Odysseus, and then lie down and float. There is an open intercom with a floozy at the desk in case you panic or something. Music, well, I say music, whale song, in fact, as you might have guessed, is then played, which, on account of the earplugs and something else besides, Boyle's Law possibly, you can hear best with your ears below the level of the water. Footnote, not even vaguely like Boyle's Law, Stephen, which is to do with gases. End footnote. You have control over the light switches, too. The idea is that you bob there, completely buoyant, utterly blind, listening to bull whales telling cow whales to get their knickers down. I sort of enjoyed it while it happened, and did feel good afterwards. Next treatment was a facial, actually just a big plug for Aramis products. Scalp revitalizer, cucumber face mask, that sort of tosh. Lovely feeling to have your face woman-handled, though. Like being made up for film or TV without the silly gossip and drivelling on about horoscopes. The Popsy also shaved me, which is always pleasurable.